This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why, for there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The time and tears went by.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is Race and Genetics, Part 5. This is a continuation of the discussion of race science, biology, human biology, and especially racial differences, the differences between groups distinguished by their interbreeding. This is what I've referred to as race science. I want to really directly continue what spoke about in the last installment, which is Fritz Lenz and the German biologist and race scientist, and the two books about him that I've been quoting from. I'm going to quote some more tonight and talk a little bit more about the larger issues going on here. The first book was I've cited previously is by Robert Proctor, a historian of science at Stanford University, still alive, still writing. His book was published in 1988, and that is Racial Hygiene: Medicine Under the Nazis. And the other book is called The Jewish Mind by a Jewish ethnographer and historian called Raphael Patai. If you're wondering what an ethnographer is, a Jewish ethnographer is a Jew who studies Jews. That was his claim to fame. Now, about this, I was introduced to both books by searching for Fritz Lenz and searching out more information about Fritz Lenz. And Proctor referred to Lenz's mentor and teacher, Alfred Plowitz, as the grandfather of racial hygiene. And I want to reiterate here by rereading how Alfred Plowitz described what racial hygiene is and the justification for it. He wrote, "Peoples and races are just organic life forms determined like beasts and plants through their component parts, cells here, men there, for which their environment is a complex of favorable or unfavorable conditions." This is very much a Darwinian view of man and man's place in nature, how he's related to other life forms. And Plowitz also described what he thought his motivation was for that justified this racial hygiene. He made an analogy of personal hygiene to what's good for the group, and he described it as being how an organic collectivity of men may keep itself as vigorous as possible and postpone its perishing as long as possible. Now, one of the points last time and that I'd like to reiterate this time that I've made is that these men that I've discussed, these scientists that were thinking about and writing about race, were not monsters, they weren't crazy, they weren't stupid, and I don't think they were evil either. They had no, if anything, they were objective to a fault, and that will be one of the points that I'm making tonight. Proctor, following in that tradition, I guess, of being objective, describes Lenz's textbook that he's well known for as a monument of scholarship and careful argumentation. And I don't think he was being sarcastic in that description. And Patai said that Lenz's attitude to the Jewish race, he put Jewish race in mocking scare quotes, but he said was unsympathetic but correct. And I'm unsympathetic to Patai's attitude, but I think in this case it's correct. What Patai had to say about Lenz that called my attention to his book was that Lenz offers an ingenious explanation for the Jewish fondness for Lamarckism. And this is really what I was trying to get at in discussing Lenz. And about that, Proctor does, I think, the better job of describing it, because he quotes Lenz at length on the subject. But he introduces it by saying, most curious of all, perhaps, is Lenz's belief that the tendency toward Lamarckism is a genetically selected racial characteristic. The Jew, Lenz writes, has a peculiar fondness for Lamarckism, the doctrine of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Hand in hand with this, quote, there usually goes a dislike of Darwinism, of the doctrine that the origin of species has been affected by the cruel process of natural selection, not by way of the peaceful inheritance of acquired characteristics, unquote. Lenz's explanation of the Jewish inclination toward Lamarckism is remarkable. This is Lenz writing a translation of Lenz himself. The Jewish inclination toward Lamarckism is obviously an expression of the wish that there should be no unbridgeable racial distinctions. For instance, it is extremely characteristic that Kammerer, who was himself both a Jew and a Lamarckian, should write that, quote, the denial of the racial importance of acquired characteristics favors racial hatred, unquote. I am personally acquainted with Jews of high mental attainments who feel themselves to belong to the German people and to German civilization, and to whom, therefore, it is a great tragedy of their lives that they should be looked upon as aliens. If acquired characters could be inherited, then by living in a Teutonic environment and by adopting a Teutonic culture, the Jews could become transformed into genuine Teutons. This enables us to understand why the Lamarckian doctrine should make so strong an appeal to the Jews, whose fate it is to exist everywhere amongst the Gentiles as a sharply differentiated minority. But this, of course, can make no difference to the fact that the Lamarckian doctrine is an illusion. Jews do not transform themselves into Germans by writing books on Goethe. About this, I think Lenz was close to the mark, but he was too objective. He was being, in fact, too kind. I don't think that the Jews in general, wish that there should be no unbridgeable racial distinctions. I think that the truth is that they wish nobody would notice them. That's what they wish. And I think also that they, generally speaking, aren't trying to be like Germans or like any of the other populations that they live amongst. They have a very strong identity of their own. And in fact, they shame and mock each other and guilt trip each other and scaremonger about blending in with the host population, as they refer to us, with the Gentiles. That would mean that their children, if they have any, wouldn't be Jews anymore. And that, to them, is like another Holocaust. They wouldn't be Jews. They wouldn't be good Jews if they really wanted to be Germans. It's the Germans that they wish would think that this is what their motivation is, that they want to be good Germans. And it's what I think the mistake that white people, not just Germans, but whites, Europeans, have made for centuries in dealing with the Jews is exactly this sort of doublethink, that the Jews have their own identity in mind, and preserving that identity at all costs, really. Even if it means the death of their host, they are going to survive. Whereas the story that they tell to the Gentiles amongst whom they live, that would be us, is different. And it's more like what Lenz was saying here. But the effect is the same, that this is what makes them want to favor positions, political positions or scientific positions, that imagine that there's no unbridgeable racial distinctions. In fact, today we see the logical extension from Lenz's time during before World War II to now what it is after World War II, which is it's forbidden, verboten to talk about racial distinctions, never mind unbridgeable racial distinctions. And as far as, who's doing this to them, the Jews do it to themselves. They want to live as a differentiated minority. It's not that the Germans forced that upon them. What Patai added to this was about Kammerer. The fellow's name was Paul Kammerer, this Jew who wrote this about Lamarckism denial leads to race hatred. He ended up killing himself in 1926 after his supposed proof of the inheritance of acquired characteristics was disproved and shown to be false. And I guess that was so devastating to him that he couldn't stand to live anymore. But I wanted to note here that this is an example of Jewish thinking. And in fact, as I cited last week, and I'd like to review here, Proctor mentioned this and thought it was scandalous, or at least wrote as if he thought he needed to represent it as scandalous, that according to Lenz, Jews can be recognized at once by their appearance, though the mental particulars of this race are even more distinctive than the physical. And the fact that Lenz referred to the Jews as a mental race. And the fact that Lenz claimed that he could recognize the literary work of a Jew. And the fact that he offered many examples, a whole range of examples for his thesis that didn't matter, it doesn't matter really. It's just oh so scandalous to imagine. And yet here we have this trait. This was one of the examples I think that that Lenz offered, is this fondness for Lamarckism. And Patai, writing in 77, doesn't deny it. He, when he refers to Lenz writing about it, he says it's an ingenious explanation for the Jewish fondness for Lamarckism, taking it for granted that there is actually a Jewish fondness for Lamarckism. Another bit that Proctor quotes from Lenz or writes about Lenz is how many Jews, in the process of adapting to essentially alien surroundings, have tried to imitate the customs and appearances of their hosts in order to blend in and appear less conspicuous. And this goes directly to why they don't want anyone to notice racial differences, is because that would scotch their crypsis, their cryptic mimicry. And that's exactly what Lenz referred to it as. He said it was a, he describes it as a typical case of animal mimicry, which is commonly observed wherever a living creature gains advantages in the struggle for existence by acquiring a resemblance to some other organism. And that's exactly what's going on, that Jews, though they see themselves as a separate group and whose interests are foremost in their mind over any other group, don't want anybody else to realize that. They want to remain disguised. And I think Lenz understood that. And he argued that Jews are not just shrewd and alert, not just diligent and persevering, but possess as well an unusual sense of empathy, an ability to put themselves in the place of others and to induce others to accept their guidance. I found that phrase, accept their guidance, induce others to accept their guidance, that's also kind of sugarcoating the reality. The word I would use is manipulate. They manipulate others to serve Jewish interests, and that's pretty obvious in the world around us today. Patai provides us another example of typical Jewish thinking. In fact, he wrote this book called The Jewish Mind that where he refers to Lenz, but in writing his Myth of the Jewish Race, that this is typical of Jewish thinking. See, the Jews don't really exist. They're just a myth. And then he goes on to write in very emotional language about the systematic extermination of 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany. That he believes firmly in. But the fact that Jews are a group to themselves, that's just a myth that Jew haters imagine is true. It's really mind-boggling the way Jews can do this, can have these two faces that they put forward and completely brazen about it, completely unsympathetic to your confusion or your interests. Let me quote more of this sentence that Bataille wrote about the systematic extermination of Jews. He actually attributes that to being the culmination of the notion that Jews were a race with distinct inherited physical and mental characteristics alien to the Gentile population in whose midst they lived, and overtly or secretly inimical to it. Now, he states the truth right there. That is the reality of the situation, is that Jews are distinct, and they do have inherited physical and mental characteristics. They are alien to the Gentile population amongst whom they live, and they are overtly or secretly inimical to us. Inimical is an interesting choice of words there. I mean, it doesn't mean that they're I don't know. It brings images to my mind of histrionics. I mean, but when you look up the word and you find out what it actually means, it just means tending to obstruct or harm, unfriendly, hostile. Yes, that's exactly what Jews are to us. From our point of view, from the point of view of Europeans, Jews are hostile. Jews have no problem expressing their beliefs that Europeans are hostile to Jews. You can read it in the media every day. You can find an example of this, of Jews telling sob stories about their history, their time amongst Europeans, and how horrible Europeans are. And it's a completely one-sided view. It's not an objective view at all. That's one of the points I wanted to make tonight, is these race scientists and how objective they were, how they tried to be objective. This fellow Lenz was objective to a fault, I think, and in general, the men who thought about in a scientific way about race were objective to a fault. In fact, you could say that that's really the defining characteristic of scientists or of science in general, is this objectiveness. And objectiveness is really, it means that you're not influenced by personal feelings or interpretations or by prejudice. You're doing something that's based on facts. You're unbiased. And you're intent on dealing with things that are external to your mind, and instead of feelings or emotions. Synonyms are words like impartial, fair, personal, disinterested, and that really does, I think, characterize science in general. And even the race scientists were able to set their group identity aside. Although that's exactly the opposite of what they're accused of retroactively, as I've cited in previous installments. They're referred to as scientific racists and social Darwinists, and both of those terms are taken as pejorative. They're intended as pejoratives. Bataille's book is titled The Jewish Mind. It's a big book all about the characteristic Jewish patterns of thought. So, you know, the fact that he tries then to deny that such a thing exists is really a good example of the Jewish mind. And I think what characterizes the white mind is, and especially the science mind, is this objectivity, this desire for understanding reality as it really is, outside of ourselves and without our own interests in mind so much. And that's why the people who are most prone to that go into science. They're drawn to it, but not amongst the Jews. That's one of the points here, is the critics of these scientists, these white scientists, tend to be Jews who aren't objective. They have the interests of their group in mind when they do their when they make their criticisms. Proctor quotes a bit of Lenz here on other white characteristics, what he refers to as Nordic characteristics. Lenz is confident that in most respects, the mental powers of Nordic man exceed those of other races. He cites Fisher's observations that the mentality of the Nordic includes industry, vigorous imagination, intelligence, foresight, organizing ability, artistic capacity, individualism, a willingness to obey orders, one-sidedness, an inclination toward mediation and flights of fancy, dislike for steady and quiet work, and devotion to plan or idea. To this, Lenz adds the qualities of self-control, self-respect, respect for life and property, desire to know the unknown, a certain wander instinct, and fondness for the sea. According to Lenz, the Nordic mind strives above all else for clarity. Nordic idealism represents a healthy realism, a sense of the actual and the essential. He also maintains that the deficiency of historical and geographical knowledge one finds amongst the British and the Americans is typically Nordic. The Nordic has less a sense of particular occurrences than of law and principle. This, in turn, he links with the Nordic's individualism and also his natural tendency toward Protestantism over Catholicism. Selection has aided the Nordic. His cold northern climes selected for intelligence and mastery of techniques. The same climate that among the Mongols selected for freedom from wants and danger and capacity to endure has selected the Nordic, in the Nordic, a love of order and of cleanliness, a love of sport, of danger, and of war, and a certain need for distance or detachment from other men and things, what Lenz calls Nietzsche's pathos of distance. Hence, objectivity is a Nordic racial trait, and Proctor puts quotes around that, so that must be an actual phrase that Lenz used. Such pronouncements may sound strange to the modern ear, yet Lenz did in fact consider his science of race to be a neutral and objective science. Indeed, he often warns against the dangers of mixing values with science. For Lenz, human racial variation is simply a fact that science is called on to analyze. The purpose of constructing a racial typology is not to rank the various races in any moral sense. Now here he's quoting Lenz. No race can be regarded as either higher or lower than another, because all such estimates of value imply the application of some standard of value other than that of race per se. He goes on to write or make an analogy to making comparisons between the Earth and Mars. And I think this is a perfect example of taking objectivity to a fault. Yes, of course, any statement that one race is higher or lower than another would be made in racial terms. I mean, as a member of my group is superior to other groups. Because it's my group, and I can't set myself apart from my group. I'd like to imagine I can, and in thinking and about science, I like to imagine I can. But bad things happen to our group when we do that, and that's, I think, something that the Jews do better than us. They realize that what's good for their group has to trump science. And it's not to say that it needs to trump reality, because it can't trump reality, but they can trump other groups, and they can trump the interests. They can do everything in their power to trump the interests of other groups that they're in a struggle for existence with. And that's another good point to make here, I think, is that I get the impression that race scientists, when they were thinking about survival of the fittest and Darwinian existence and the struggle for survival between groups, maybe underestimated just how much that struggle would spill over into science itself. They thought that science was this ideal of logic and reason and was therefore somehow a part, a neutral ground. And it isn't. And that was very much to the detriment of white people that we made that mistake and that we continue to make that mistake today. The thing about Jews is they're not us. And the main way that they're different is that they do try to disguise themselves as us. And I think that most whites, including eminent race scientists, the ones that I've been talking about, misunderstand the nature of the Jews and underestimate them. And a big reason for that is our tendency toward objectivity, toward logic and reason, this search for the truth, this desire to get an objective view of reality around us. But unlike the tortoises and the finches that Darwin studied and was able to think about and write whatever he wanted about, you can't do that with the Jews. When you say something or you start thinking in a way that they consider, they regard as bad for them, they fight back. They bite. They punish. They boycott. They alter the environment itself to make that bad for you and to discourage it in any way that they can. And they're not shy about doing that. And in that respect, they prove actually the struggle between groups that we're all supposed to imagine doesn't actually exist, that it was all just the imaginations of biased racist scientists that were just, you know, the view today is supposedly that these race scientists were actually secretly trying to do what was best in for their people. And so they created these elaborate scientific excuses to form the policies that were bad for Jews. And that's an inversion of the reality. It's a projection, really, of what Jews are doing, disguising themselves and their motives and essentially warring on us covertly. This business about hiding and disguising themselves is a key survival tactic for them. This is one of the techniques that they use for their group survival. It's one of the things that differentiates them from white people. White people are fairly open and honest about what we're doing. If we don't like you, we declare war on you and we go to war. But we try as hard as we can not to do that and beforehand, whereas Jews don't operate that way. This is a very important point, this business about mimicry. It's not imaginary. We're not crazy to imagine that that Jews are trying to disguise themselves. I'll give many examples of that when I talk more specifically about Jews, but I think in the next, I still have several installments to do here, still focused on race science, and but I think I've pretty much wrapped up everything I wanted to say about lens and racial hygiene, and I'll have something different to talk about next time. Unfortunately, it will still involve the Jews and their clash with white scientists over racial science.